You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of August, 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, Greece rethinks whether inventing democracy was such a bright idea after all, as the country braces itself for yet another election. My guests Nina Schick and Michael Binion will discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Marine Le Pen of France's National Front completes her act of simultaneous patricide and regicide and bounces her dad out of the party he founded. We'll also look at the rise of similarly inclined parties across hitherto liberal Scandinavia. The United States' request for Australia to join the country-striking Islamic State on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border, and Hillary Clinton's email imbroglio. Can she extricate herself before the primaries get properly underway? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the programme. My guests today are Monocle 24 contributors Nina Schick from EU policy think tank Open Europe and Michael Binion, a long-time foreign correspondent currently with The Times here in London. Welcome both. We will start tonight with Greece, a country fond of reminding everyone else that they invented democracy, and certainly the intervening centuries have not diminished their enthusiasm for it. The beleaguered country will shortly have what feels like at least its dozenth election and or referendum this year, following the resignation of Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, whose Syriza party, observing the immemorial tradition of populist left-wing movements, has split. Nina, first of all, the Judean People's Front in this scenario appear to be called the Popular Unity Party. It's one of those names they just seem to have conjured by pulling sort of regular adjectives out of a hat. But how different from Syriza are they likely to be?
Well, they're mostly the left, radical left-wing of Syriza, and actually this split was inevitable, and the snap elections that have been called are inevitable as well, because obviously Tsipras, after campaigning for anti-austerity, saying no to the creditors' conditions, you know, then turned around and tried to pass a third bailout through the parliament. And at the time, a third of his party voted against him. So it's inevitable that he now was going to call these elections to shore up support for his mandate. And also, unsurprising, that a large segment of Syriza on the further left wing is saying, well, we're not going to stand for this because we campaigned on a mandate against austerity and we're not going to accept these conditions. But ironically, the thing that will probably be the outcome of all of this is that Tsipras will win the snap election, will probably be held in September with the support of the other parties, and that will only give him further credence to put through the reforms.
Michael, as Nina correctly points out, and I think I've got this right, Alexis Tsipras won office as the anti-austerity candidate. He's now effectively running in this election as the austerity candidate after a referendum in which most of the Greek population rejected austerity, and yet the same Greek population are currently bestowing upon him an approval rating of about 61%.
Well, that's pretty clever of him. And actually, it's some pretty smart sleight of hand. In fact, if you look at the long-term trajectory, it's the right thing to have done, because he campaigned like hell against the austerity measures, and in doing so infuriated virtually all the Europeans, but then went back to the party and went back to the country and said, look, do you approve of this? And they immediately said, we don't like austerity. So he then had the mandate, then said, do you want to have Greece stay in the euro? And by an overwhelming majority, people made it clear they did. So he then went back thinking his hand was strengthened. It wasn't. He negotiated a deal, but he also was able to tell the Greeks, you see, I did the best I could. I don't like austerity. You want to stay in the referendum. This is the only deal we can get, and this is what we're going to have to live with if you want to stay in the euro. And they do, and they probably will follow him through these twists and turns.
Nina, the new party, the Popular Unity Party, is led by the former energy minister Panagiotis Lafazanis. He says he will respect the referendum result in which Greek people voted to reject the austerity package which their government has basically signed up to. Is that even possible at this point? If by some bizarre fluke the Popular Unity Party were to end up leading the next government. Can he rewind time at this point?
Well, I mean, if he were to win, so basically they now have 3 days to try and form a majority coalition government, which is unlikely. But let's say for the sake of argument that he did, they've already signed the conditions. They've already signed this bailout with the creditors. So what would happen is essentially it would take us right back to where we were in January when Syriza came into power, campaigning against austerity, and then said, well, we don't want to abide by the conditions of the second bailout anymore. And everyone else said, well, you can't do that because you've signed it. And you can't use the argument of democracy in this case because you're talking about money that's been given by the rest of the Eurozone. So you're also talking about national democracies in other European countries. There's no reason why a democratic vote in Greece trumps a democratic vote in the other Eurozone countries. So you would end up exactly where you were before.
Michael, it's most pundits seem to think that there's not much in the way of likely outcome here other than some sort of government led by Alexis Tsipras. Certainly he has the personal approval rating to secure a mandate, you would think. So if this election does take place, and the date most people are suggesting is September 20th, and if Syriza does lead the next government with Alexis Tsipras as the Prime Minister, does that at least get us to a beginning of the end of Greece's crisis?
Well, beginning of the political imbroglio, yes, and beginning of the end of that, but not really an end to the economic difficulties, because a lot of people say that even with this bailout, Greece is going to really struggle to meet the conditions. And there's a lot of scepticism among the creditors. I mean, the Germans are by far from convinced that actually this bailout is going to work. And there's been, as we saw in Germany, quite a sizable vote against the bailout package from Merkel's own party. That reflects considerable opinion in Germany and also in other richer northern European countries, Finland, Netherlands, elsewhere, that it's not going to work. You're just pouring good money after bad. So I think if there is further political wriggle, basically the creditors are going to call the line or rather call the bluff and say, that's it, you're out. You're not staying in the euro. We're not lending anymore. You're not abiding by the conditions. The money will now halt. It's up to you. And I think the Greeks sort of, I'm not sure whether they really realise that yet, but they're still on a knife edge.
Nina, what does happen in the not altogether unlikely event that Greece needs a fourth bailout?
Well, I think Michael is absolutely correct in saying that, you know, the economic conditions will not get better for Greece. And I think that, of course, this bailout is for 86 billion. You already have estimates that they'll need a lot more than that. You know, the money set aside just for recapitalization of banks, they're saying, is not going to be enough. And I think the creditors are well aware of that. Why? Because the fundamental the issue here is that Greece has an unsustainable debt burden. It just simply cannot pay back its debt. However, given the structure of the bailout and Greece being a member of the Eurozone where you can't give other members money for free, i.e. they have to pay it back by the laws of the euro, Greece cannot get a haircut, which is the reason the IMF is, you know, very upset and not sure whether they're going to partake in the bailout or not. So that means that the economic problems for Greece are not over. And I think the political problems are not over either. I think it'll subdue for a little while and it won't be long before we're back here again. And maybe that time Brexit trigger will be pulled. I mean, I was pretty certain that this time it was actually going to happen. But never underestimate the political will to keep the euro together.
Okay, well, staying in Europe, we will look now at France, where the veteran far-right blowhard Jean-Marie Le Pen has now been formally expelled from the party he founded, and by his own daughter, no less. Le Pen Sr. has accomplished the remarkable feat of being bounced out of the National Front on the grounds of overt anti-Semitic crankiness, which is perhaps akin to being bounced out of the National Philatelic Society due to excessive enthusiasm for postage stamps. Elsewhere in Europe, however, like-minded parties are doing dishearteningly well. A recent poll in Sweden put the anti-immigration Sweden Democrats in top spot. Michael, it is only, what are we up to now, for 2015? It's only 13 years, which isn't that long since Jean-Marie Le Pen made it to the runoff of a French presidential election. Who are his people exactly? And are the Front National's people the same people that they were back then?
Not exactly the same. They've gathered a whole lot more strength and supporters from the way that the daughter has broadened the appeal. The anti-Semitic thing, of course, this was a deep embarrassment, which could only harm the National Front's reputation not only in France but all over the world. It was the kind
of apart from that cohort of its followers, yes, with whom it would improve their reputation
of people who are irreconciled to democracy, to liberalism, to anything really, apart from cranky right wing fanatical views. But Marine Le Pen is appealing to a much wider group, and that is to people who are worried about immigration, and in particular about immigration from North Africa, which is the main issue in France. The very large number of Arabs from Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, all around there. And she's also appealing to kind of traditional French values, to a party that has been, to a public that has been confused by France's diminished status in the world, its sort of feeling that it's no longer has the same strength as Germany, and all that. And in fact, that's quite a successful strategy. But to pursue it, she has to dump this cranky, illiberal, disgusting, anti-Semitic and sort of pro-Nazi view that her father has.
So, Nina, Marine has now officially purged her ghastly father from her own party. As Michael correctly points out, immigration is the Front National's big issue, if arguably their only issue. But it is a big issue. In fact, a poll, I think, here in the UK I was reading this morning said among British voters it is now the number one concern, whether rightly or wrongly, it is the thing they're most concerned about. If the migrants keep coming, and there's no reason I can imagine that they won't, is Marine Le Pen a serious contender in 2017?
She certainly could be. And the thing is, also with immigration, it's not only in France, even in countries like Germany, which have very liberal attitudes towards immigration. For the first time ever, in a poll just last week, immigration was a primary concern. Unsurprising, it's probably the biggest issue facing Europe, and a massive, massive problem where there are no easy answers. The EU hasn't been able to respond, and it can't respond to something like this. One interesting thing that Michael picked up, in which we were discussing about how the party is trying to, dump the toxic elements and therefore have a broader appeal. You see this happening all across Europe with the right-wing parties. The Danish People's Party in Denmark, the Sweden Democrats, who of course just got 25% in a poll, up from 12.5% in the elections last just a few months ago. Incredible. And broadly speaking, these parties have a lot of appeal and sway because they do sound reasonable. They're not like your swivel-eyed loons. They try to make their rhetoric quite reasonable in a way that's quite sophisticated. And they have a broad appeal on immigration and also anti-bailout and anti-EU sentiment.
As Nina points out, Michael, the anti-immigration populist parties, including UKIP here in the UK, do their very, very best to try and appear reasonable and to try officially at least to separate themselves from any taint of racism or old-school far-right crankiness. But as Nina also points out, Sweden, a country which has been famously generous to successive waves of immigration in the last 20, 30 years from Bosnia, Iraq, Syria, they are gaining real traction, a party with some fairly unsavoury roots in the far-right fringes. Does it suggest that, I mean, my own pet theory is that one of the reasons it's become a big thing is that the European left, and indeed the European centre, has just taken a complete pass on the subject of immigration. It doesn't even want to discuss it for fear of being thought of as in any way racist. It won't acknowledge that there are non-racist reasons to be concerned about immigration. Is this something that left-wing parties have to start engaging with?
Absolutely, and that's true in Britain as well as true of everywhere. The Labour Party hardly discussed immigration seriously during the recent election campaign in Britain.
They did make a mug. There was a coffee mug.
A coffee
with
mug
a slogan on it.
Not quite the right way to tackle an issue as fundamental as that. Sweden has been famously liberal on things like this, but it is, as Enoch Powell, a former very hard-line far-right Tory, said something like 30 or 40 years ago, it's all a question of numbers. That's what really matters. Sweden has taken in a huge number of people from outside, not just recently, although they are still taking asylum seekers, but for the past 20 or 30 years they've taken people from places that have a very different cultural, religious and in every way lifestyle background from Sweden. And not surprisingly, they found it very difficult to integrate these people into Swedish society. And as a result, these people have fared fairly poorly in many many places, and the Swedes are beginning to think, well, we don't want any more of them. And I think that there is a real problem about to what extent and how quickly you are able to integrate outsiders, especially from countries far away with very different traditions, such as Afghanistan or Eritrea or something like that, who don't fit very easily into modern Western secular societies.
This was the argument, certainly most famously adumbrated by the late Pim Fortuyn in the Netherlands. I can remember not long after he was assassinated, interviewing a few of his associates and camp followers in the Netherlands, some of whom were just awful people who didn't like foreigners very much, but others of whom were making the point that the reason we are concerned is we are a liberal people who believe in gay marriage and emancipation of women, etc., etc., etc. Nina, is there a legitimate concern that is not, that this isn't being addressed by the left? And if that continues, are we going to see right-wing populism rising in approximate proportion with incoming migration?
Absolutely. You have to have a reasonable debate about it. If you just dismiss the issue because it's taboo and you don't want to go there because it's a bit too controversial, you say, oh, I don't want to be painted as a racist, then inevitably this is going to happen. And Sweden is the perfect example of where that has happened. Because the mainstream parties, if you go to Sweden, you know, the mainstream political thinking for a very long time was, you know, it's and they get much laud for being so liberal with their migration policy. But the fact that it has caused some people to feel stressed as people are not able to integrate, et cetera, et cetera. And because they haven't been able to have a reasonable debate, that leads to the rise of parties like the Sweden Democrats, who've gone up meteorically quickly. And I expect, as long as you are not able to have a sensible discussion about this or able to integrate people from very different cultures better into your society, then that will continue.
Okay, we'll have to take a short break now, but we should close this conversation on an optimistic note, which is that there is some public sympathy at large, at least in Austria, where top of the iTunes charts at the moment is A Minute of Silence, which is being sold as a means of raising funds for immigrants currently lacking anywhere to sleep. We will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. I'll be back with Michael Binion and Nina Schick on the other side of a couple of promos. Coming up next, Australia ponders joining airstrikes against Islamic State in Syria, and the Hillary Clinton email brouhaha. Does it yet warrant the dreaded gate suffix?
Do you have dreams of running your own business? Or do you just wish you had a nicer desk? Well, you require the September issue of Monocle that comes with an entrepreneurial dusting of good advice, inspiring stories, and contacts for better office furniture. And we have more.
In the affairs section, we sit down with Turkey's charismatic new opposition leader, and we also take a look inside the secretive world of the Order of Malta, one of the strangest and smallest sovereign entities in the world.
We open the business section this month with a report on the global companies that operate behind the scenes. CPI, NXP and Kotobuki might not be household brand names, but we all use their products every day. We just don't know it.
The September issue of Monocle is on sale now. Get your copy at any good newsstand or do the wise thing. Become a subscriber at monocle.com.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatised am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had a debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
Welcome back to Midori House. I'm Monocle 24. Still with me, Michael Binion from The Times, Nina Schick from Open Europe. Now, the Royal Australian Air Force appears poised to join the airborne posse striking Islamic State targets inside Syria as well as in Iraq. The United States has already submitted a formal request for Australia's increased involvement, which doesn't sound like the sort of question you ask if you think there's much danger of the answer being no. Michael, first of all, this will amount to six FA-18s from the RAAF. What difference are they going to make, really? Is this cosmetic or strategic?
It's more than cosmetic. It's political, I think. It's certainly not strategic. As you say, it's not going to make that much difference having six Australian planes. A little bit, perhaps, but it's political. It's binding Australia firmly to the same crusade, if that's the right word, that the Americans...
One they're trying to avoid, I would think.
It certainly is, yes. To the same campaign the Americans are undertaking to eradicate this extreme, unpleasant, brutal regime from the region. And I think it will be very welcome to most Arab allies of the United States. And particularly, don't forget, domestically, it's quite important. There are a lot of people of Middle Eastern origin now living in Australia.
Indeed so.
So for them, it's quite important to be seen to take sides in this way.
Australia's opposition leader, Bill Shorten, has muttered something about wanting clarification about the legality of this. Tony Abbott, the Prime Minister, says there's little difference between the legalities of striking on both sides of the border and none at all on the morality of it. Nina, is any of that analysis wrong?
Well, that's typical Tony, isn't it? Straight talking.
For better and for worse, for, yes.
He's been flexing his diplomatic muscles there. Of course, there is... I think, of course, that should be debated. And I think it's right that those objections are raised. But in this kind of tenuous situation, I mean, if we were to look where who's being struck, which civilians are being killed, et cetera, I think it's, you know, it's obviously a very tenuous and difficult situation where there must be atrocities being committed on both sides, also by, of course, the West. However, I think it's quite interesting that since Tony's come to office, he's... I think he was underestimated in terms of his foreign policy, maybe. And since he's come...
He was underestimated in most respects.
Yeah, but after...
Quite accurately.
But after MH17, obviously, after the airplane was shot down, it's quite impressive to see how he lobbied for that team to get access to the MH17 site. And since then, of course, Australia has been involved supplying arms to the Iraqi... in Iraq, been involved in strikes in Iraq. So, yeah, I think they will... obviously be bound to this by America as well.
I think it goes back quite a long way because Australia has been a fairly loyal and reliable ally of the United States for some time. I mean, think Vietnam.
I struggle to think of a post-World War II American war we haven't turned up for, actually.
That's right. That's right. It is something that Australia feels important for its own both identity and for the security of its participation in the Western alliance part of, you know, they are a country that is very different from the rest of Asia. It's a separate continent. It feels it has cultural, historic, ideological links with the West, particularly Europe and America. And it wants to demonstrate that that is still the case.
Michael, there, just to follow up on that point that Nina was making about the significance, legal, moral, or otherwise, of the border between Iraq and Syria. If it doesn't appear to mean anything to Islamic State, and it clearly doesn't, should it mean anything to the people fighting them?
I think it really is almost academic. I think there's a difficulty with public opinion or a difficulty with parliamentary opinion. I mean, that's certainly the case in Britain. We had a vote against intervention in Syria, and the government has been quite careful, therefore, not to say, well, we actually are intervening in Syria. They've been careful to say we're only confining our activities to Iraq. But for all practical purposes, it's quite obvious that this border doesn't really exist except as a theoretical line in the sand. And people and terrorism and atrocities and arms and all that, they flow backwards and forwards. So it's not as if the Syrian government had control of this area at all.
Okay, well, I want to look finally at the United States and a couple of stories pertaining to the presidential election. First of all, Hillary Clinton's coronation as the Democrat nominee is looking slightly less inevitable than previously. At issue is her habit while serving as Secretary of State of employing a private email server at her home. A federal judge has now suggested that she violated government procedure by doing this. Nina, it is hard to say. This this is a possibly slightly opaque procedural question that's going to revolve around perception more than reality. How much trouble do you think she's in?
I think she could certainly be in a lot of trouble, and I think that you know, the Republicans aren't going to let this one go easily. Obviously, she has that Senate committee hearing coming up, and certainly Republican members of that committee will press her on it, and the Congress committee, and two Senate committees have started raising questions about it as well, and at a time ahead of the elections, I don't think they'll let that one slide. And interestingly, the polls have shown, since, you know, the story broke, since the New York Times broke the story, she's gone down a lot in the polls, and specifically on issues such as trust, because it does kind of smack a little bit of, oh, rules are for, you know, for the little people, because
rules are for non-Clintons.
Because, you know, the State Department issued guidelines saying, you know, other people working there should not send these type of emails from their private message, from their private accounts, and of course they've been saying, oh, it had no classified information, but Reuters did an investigation and they looked a little bit further into it. And if anything is said by, you know, in confidence to you by a foreign diplomat, that is from birth classified information, even though it hasn't been marked as classified. So yes, maybe a bit pedantic, but, you know, I find it astounding that she didn't even have a government email account activated.
Well, this is the thing that gets me, and it at very least raises, I think, a reasonable question about her judgment. And I'll put this to you, Michael, that I'm Secretary of State. I'm planning on running for president when I'm done here. I'm going to set up a private email server in my home. There's absolutely no way that could look dodgy.
Well, I think it's more an oversight than a deliberate misdemeanor or a deliberate attempt to conceal information or to get round the rules. But her great fault is not to say right from the start, oh yes, I got that wrong, I should have done that. It's the whole point of, if you've made a mistake, fess up straight away and don't let things dribble out. That's exactly what went wrong with Watergate. Most Americans really don't care one way or the other the ins and outs of whether you should have a private email or a government email. It's not something that actually is of massive concern. But what is of concern is if you look untrustworthy. And that's the way the Republicans are playing it quite cleverly.
Well, this was the wisdom of Watergate, that it's not the crime that gets you, it's the cover-up.
It is, yes.
But this was always Bill Clinton's way, wasn't it, though? It was just deny until you can't anymore, at which point you then have to
It's a human reaction, actually, and particularly if you're having shenanigans in the Oval Office, that's that's a slightly different issue. But on this particular thing, she didn't need to sort of string it out for so long. She should have said right from the start to her aides, look, have a look. Is there anything there? If so, let's get it all out straight away. And she did in the end get it all out, but it was already then too late and it looked as though it had been forced out. And the problem about that is that it said to a number of Democrats, my goodness, maybe we should have looked a bit harder at other alternatives. It's like the kind of regret that you have when you've just bought a smart car and you think this is a fine, shiny car, but actually you haven't looked at any other ones in the market. And that's what the Democrats are now feeling.
Before we go, we do have one more presidential election story to look at. I mean, the presidential election is obviously a serious business, but its early stages are nevertheless being dominated by the attention-seeking of a patently ludicrous pretender with no experience of public office. And yes, I'm doing a whole bit enough of Donald Trump thing here. We're going to consider the insurgency of one Deez Nuts, who is so far polling in high single digits in North Carolina, Iowa, and Minnesota. He is, in fact, a 15-year-old high school student from Iowa, name of Brady Olson. Nina, leaving aside the fact that under the US Constitution, I think he's 20 years too young to run for the presidency, do we like his chances at all?
Well, I think he could do as good of the job as Trump if he ever made it to the Oval Office. It's great, isn't it? It's a fantastic story. Well done to him.
Okay, Michael, where do you stand on comedy candidates generally? Because a lot have, as always do, the current, there's 500-odd people who are officially running for president. Some obvious joke candidates, Sydney's Voluptuous Buttocks, Buddy the Cat, Bailey D. Dog, Mike Huckabee. Are you one of those people who finds this subverting of the democratic process amusing?
Yes. They add to the joys of life. Well, they turn up in every country. I mean, Britain has had a long tradition of this. Screaming Lord Such from the Monster Raving Loony Party regularly polls quite respectable numbers, and he doesn't always lose his deposit. It's a protest vote. I mean, look, it can get out of hand. We saw a protest vote in Italy, the Pirates Party, where they ended up with a large trunk in Parliament with not quite sure, you know, they then had to think of some policies for themselves. And there is a real problem with parties that start off as a joke and suddenly become serious. You might say Donald Trump is exactly one of those.
Or indeed, you could look closer to home at the Britain's Labour Party at the moment. We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Michael Binion from The Times, Nina Schick from Open Europe. Thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's episode of Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Eleanor Nikulacheva and Federica Romaniello. Our studio manager was Chris Grimes. The next half hour, Josh Fennett is in the chair with Monocle's International Playlist. Marcus Hippie is in at 1900 hours with The Menu. At 2200, I'm back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time, but for this edition, it's goodbye, thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.